How the fuck was Portugal?
Let's talk. Oh my God. You really want me to jump off that bridge already?
The bridge, okay. You have to.
I mean, it was really great. It was like Jurassic Park, the movie, but no danger of dinosaurs or even anything because there's like no weird snakes or spiders even
yeah,
there.
But
it's just
felt
beautiful.
Dangerous.
It's a jungle with no predators.
It did feel a little bit dangerous though. Am I wrong? Because there were some videos. There's some content that you're publishing for the people, aka me.
The waterfall was very scary. There were some things that we did that I was like, oh, because that's the thing. I think in America, they're so afraid they'll be sued that you're not allowed to go places. And if you are, it's very Disney-fied with kid gloves where it's like, this is how to not die here. And this was a little like, yeah, go check anything out you want. And there's 1,000 ways to die. Most people don't. Don't worry
about it.
There's
50 ways to name a lover and 1,000 ways to die.
It was really like going to see some of these waterfalls and things and just no safety precautions in place. And you're like standing 200 feet above like rushing water. And you're like, why are my children allowed to just be here and they can duck under this bar? Like
that. Did it cause you insane amounts of anxiety?
Insane.
Was Matt chill? Matt's, I feel like, a good guy to be.
Even Matt's a good barometer. And he was like, that was very insane. It's like, yeah. And he's fine if it's him and I, but I think that the feeling
no,
of
like. It's
like
you have kids that
it's
are
your
walking.
3-year-old.
Yeah. And Griffin is like.
Who like trips a lot and is like not tuned in. So it was really scary. And we had some really beautiful, I think like we had an amazing trip. The kids did really well. I forgot that in Europe, people like kids so much. So like you go to a fancy restaurant and you're like, oh, sorry. We won't go here. Like when you realize how fancy it looks, like we went to a hotel and they had a hotel bar you could eat at, or you could eat at the really nice restaurant and the prices were the same. The restaurant just had like better stuff. And when I saw how nice the restaurant looked, I was like explaining to the people that worked there that we were going to do the bar and they were like, why? And I was like, cause we have our kids with us. And they were like, so, and I was like, well, they're 3, they're 6. Like they don't know how to be in a restaurant. And they were like, sure they do. They like convinced me and like brought my kids like coloring books and French fries. And it was like, they just like everyone in Europe doesn't get sitters and then go out. They just bring their kids to dinners at 10 o'clock and their kids fall asleep at the dinner.
Quinn, it's so funny. I've been to Europe so many times. I've never been with a child. And that is so fucking interesting. That is so fascinating.
So it's just like, it's just a different thought process of like, yeah, your family's always together at dinner and it doesn't matter if it's super late at night and doesn't make sense for the kids. They just can sleep if they need to sleep or color or run around or whatever.
Are you me? Or did you come back from your European travels and you're like, in Europe, the children come out with the parents?
Let me tell you about Europe, Gary. Let me tell you about Europe. The funnier things that happened, the like travel moments where you're like, oops, was that I tried to look at TripAdvisor to get a feeling for what restaurants to go to. And I don't know why, but like, so many restaurants get like 4.5, 5 stars, like 4.7 stars. And people are like, this is so perfect and authentic. And then you go and it's like,
it's not perfect.
It is
and
weird,
it's not
weird. Well, it's like, it is authentic, but it's like a hole in the wall that the fishermen go to after they fish, which you want.
Yeah.
Like you want a good sample size of everything, but I just never knew what we were walking into, which was totally funny.
So you're like, am I going into this like 5-star restaurant, like gorgeous linens,
or am I going into
like a hole in the wall with just like fish on a stick?
Yes. Like we walked into this place our second night that just cracked me up that like we walked in and there were all these men, these like farmers standing at the bar, had no stools. They were just standing and their boots were covered in mud, but they were drinking glasses of wine, which is also so European.
I love that.
You know? And we walk in and I'm like, oh, do you guys have a dining room to have dinner in? And they were like, yes, right this way. And the woman that took us, the dining room is big and empty because it's early. It's like 6:30 and nobody eats dinner at 6:30. There's one couple having dinner in this empty
and
dining room.
And they're also speaking English.
She seats us.
Next to them.
next to them. Empty dining room. And you're like, wow, what a choice. So I'm like, well, kids, be good. You're about to ruin this couple's dinner.
Do you want to know why? Because it's easier for the server. Because at the end of the day, they don't want to have to walk across the fucking room. And you know what?
Sure.
Hell yeah, I don't blame them.
Good on them. So she's like, what can I get you? And we're ordering. And it's like that language thing where there's just enough of a language thing where I'm like pointing at pictures and being like, is this this? And like, I don't really know what I'm doing. And it's very... I wanted to get a glass of wine. And I know that sometimes when you order white wine, they just give you like this sweet, inedible
shit. You gotta get the Vino Verde. Vino Verde.
Well, what I said was, I'd like a glass of white wine, anything that's not sweet. I just want it to be dry. And she looked confused and worried. And then she walked away without saying anything. And Matt was about to order his beer because he was not into the wine there. He was like too scared that he was going to make a mistake. So he just was ordering like local beers, which was cute too. Super Brock was the local beer.
Yes, Super and so, Brock. I had that a lot.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So he went to go order a beer, but the woman had already walked away. And then a very old, I would put him in his 80s, man came out with no teeth at all. Very serious looking and no teeth. And like kind of, he looked like a toad kind of, then in like a cartoon way. Yeah. Like, you know, in a way where you would like.
His eyes were just a little bit wider. His eyes were a little wider set.
And no teeth at all. And he comes up to the table silently with a bottle of wine and like slams it on the table and opens it, puts two glasses down, pours them and walks away. And Matt goes, did you just order a bottle of wine? And I said, yes, but I'm not going to say anything to the toothless silent sommelier that just came to the table. Like, are you? And he's like, no, I'm not talking to that guy. Like, he seemed to know what we needed, and I think we should trust him. And I was like, I agree.
Wait, how was the wine?
Totally weird, but you know what I mean? It was just that, it's that travel moment where you're like, well, we're gonna drink it all. We don't want to be rude, and we don't want to be sober. More importantly, we don't want to be sober.
Wait, was it cheap there?
Yes, glasses of wine, €3.
€3. That bottle of wine probably was €10. I guarantee
really
you.
Really nice entrees, €15. It was just like really, really chill to get food there. We went to a couple nicer places that were in hotels that charged more New York-y prices. Yeah. But everything else was so affordable, and all the nature stuff, everything we did was free. So, you know, we went to a few hot springs that cost a little bit for each person to get in. They do a cool thing where they're like, when you go to the really busy hot springs that are not at all busy in February because it's off season, their system is that you pay for 90 minutes. And then if you want to hang out more, you have to go pay again. And they do it because they want – it's like in the middle of the jungle, like a beautiful hot springs. And they don't want it to get like crowded because it would feel suddenly like weird.
I got to go to the Azores. I got to go. I'm so glad you went. Do you feel like you're did your mental health get cured?
No, I'm still a very sick woman.
Okay, cool.
But thank you for checking in on that. I would say that.
Here's the thing. It's let it be a lesson. The things that we do that we think are going to be like the answer might not always be the answer. But you know what? I'm glad I do them. I'm glad we do them.
Me too. No, this was so special. It was really amazing to see that not only – because we travel with our kids a lot, but to see like relatives and things. And so to have – a full-blown, what I would call adventure travel. Yeah. Like it wasn't go to an all-inclusive in Puerto Vallarta, bless you if you do it, but where like basically you're going because you know that everything will be taken care of and every amenity is at your fingertips and everyone will like take care of you. Like this was adventure travel. This was the kind of travel Matt and I did.
Before kids.
That's and to do it with kids and be able to do it and have the kids be both so enthusiastic. Like they were both really excited by all the things that we did and they could really rock it.
I'm so stoked for you guys because I think this was like very much a first step in that direction to be like, what is some travel that we can do that the kids will love, that we will love, that we'll all be sane for? And I'm so glad it went well because I remember when Koa was a baby and he had that really scary allergy to peanuts. The first thing you said to me was like, oh, I'm just so sad he can't ever go to Thailand. And of course, because there's a lot of peanuts there. So like, obviously, traveling has always been something that you want to do with your kids. And, you know, I think what's interesting is I don't think you and Matt sat down and were like, when Griffin is three, we'll take him to Europe for the first time. No, it was like this thing came up and you said, let's try it. And I'm so glad it went well. I'm so glad it went well. And I'm so glad
I am too.
That you, because you and Matt love traveling and it's so good for your brain. It's so good for your soul. Like, it's chicken soup for the soul, travel.
It is.
So I'm very glad it went well. I'm really, really glad.
Yeah, we had such a good time.
By the way,
what's going on with your trip?
We can talk about it next week, but I am in the thick of tour life. Okay, so some big updates. I'm now in the show.
Yes, that is a really big update. I mean, that's a big shift. We didn't know that was going to happen. Now Carrie's in the, she was a behind the scenes person. But you know what I mean? It makes sense. You meet Carrie and you're like, this woman belongs on stage. Somebody give her a microphone. Hurry.
I was like.
Smartest thing they did. Smartest thing they could have done.
So it's great. So the first 2 weeks I've been on the whole show, which has been, I will say, a lot, because as a company manager, I'm also like managing everyone's food and accounting. Like I've like taken on like 40 jobs on this tour and I feel it. I feel it. I feel like a lot of jobs. And what's been really exciting is I think part of my job is to add some levity, which I want to thank this podcast for, because I think like even when we're talking about the depths of like of horror, you know,
yes.
I do feel like, you know, I've been able to add some jokes here and there, which offers some levity. But I also think part of my job is making sure she feels comfortable on stage. You know, I mean, she's new to this. This is a new thing for her. And what's really exciting is the first 2 weeks I've been the whole show. And then just the other day, she got to go at it alone the first half. And then I come on and I moderate the Q&A. So I do like a little bit of an opening. I'm like I'm like an opening comic for her, essentially, in the beginning now. And then she comes on and does like a little bit of a speech. And then the second half, I come on with Q&A. So it's nice. So like the first half now I can like get some work done while she's on stage and then come back and do a Q&A. So I've been learning.
What do they do for the intro now?
The intro?
If you're not doing the intro.
I am doing the intro. But I was before I was on stage the whole time.
What, just sitting and watching her?
Interacting, like having a conversation during like her speech and like – and like asking questions or Claire, you know, things like that. So like I would come on stage, do an intro, invite her out. She'd sit down. She would go through her formula for a serial killer is kind of the premise of the show, the psychology of it. And then we'd get cues. We get questions in the second at intermission. And then I'd come back.
So now you vanish and you come
now
back.
Now I vanish and I come back. Now I like.
And you like that better because you can do things during your vanishing.
I mean, I'm still watching because I think I am. I'm making sure that, you know.
Don't worry. She won't listen. You're not watching.
I am. No, the first, because we've done it once. We've done it once because the main director is out and they send videos to the team to see how it's going. And so the other day, you know. She did really great and I didn't have to interrupt her. You know, I kind of kept my distance and I was like, I think she's ready to go at it alone. So I feel like a little bit, I'm like, you know, helping guide the process.
And that's so cool.
It's really fun. It's fun to see her too, like expand herself and own the stage. And I think the more time alone she gets, the more she's going to really feel it. I'm just tired. Like I've been, like, yesterday I drove 8 hours.
City.
Yeah, I haven't even been able to explore. Like, we get to a city, I go to the theater, I get everybody's food, I do all this, I answer emails, I do all this stuff, and then I perform, and then we, like, go to the hotel, I answer emails, and I sleep, and I wake up, and I do it all over again. And I think...
Holy shit.
It's, like, it's a lot. Like, I would say...
That is a lot.
I would say it's too much, actually.
I think it's too much, but I also think it'll be great because when you go from this into doing your show, you'll be like, wow, it's so nice that I don't have to do 9 jobs.
It is. It's going to – well, one, I'm excited to come back to New York for 5 days and just have like a little bit of like – you know what I mean? Like I'm going to go see friends and I'm going to actually, I think, like use that time to rest. I mean, although I can't rest. I have to like get ready for my UK tour, but – then I'm going to be in Florida with my family. I'll see them. I need to find a way to recharge.
Don't forget to stretch. Don't forget to move your body.
I haven't moved my body enough at all because I haven't found time.
I know, but even just if you can like
put on music and
15
dance.
15 minutes of yoga on even just your hotel room floor, you're going to feel like
a million bucks
better.
I know. I need to do that. Yeah. I'm learning so much. I also like what I wanted to do, I think I've done, which is, you know, when I came on to do this job, I'm a backstage girl and I was known as an actor. And I've worked with this company before. And what's been amazing is I think they've seen me in a different light. You know, they've seen me as a creative person and someone who can direct and someone who is, you know, and I'm excited that I think that could open some more opportunities in this realm of like,
yeah,
which is really
so
great.
What's the rest of the tour going to be? You're just going to come in for the Q&A.
I think so. They're having me introduce her. Like I'm telling true crime jokes. Like I tell you, mm-hmm. You'll appreciate this in Colorado. I was just in Parker, Colorado. And it was a Sunday matinee and we never do Sunday matinees. And so I was like, oh my gosh, wow, everybody's here. This is great. What a bunch of weirdos we all are here at this show. And I was like, it was funny when we came in, there was a church service here. And so I just think it's really a great sort of like a series of events. We have like a church service and then we have psychology of serial killers. And then I like really thought about it and I thought, you know what book has a lot of true crime in it? The Bible.
The Bible.
The Bible. I was like, so
that's
it
good.
Actually totally makes sense. So let's get started.
Total.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's
I can't
really
use that
funny.
For any other days, but I'll use it for the next two Sundays I have because I think that's fun.
That's
a fun
one.
Joke. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. By the way, you're listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creepily.
I'm Gwendolyn
and
Bosner.
I'm Carrie Ipama. And I feel like we haven't seen each other in so long, so I'm glad we were able to take a little deep dive. And we're going to talk about it more because I have so many more tour stories and things that I want to talk about. But we have to thank some Patreons.
Yeah, let's do it. I would say that we can first send out a big thanks to Alex B.
Alex B. Alex B. You mean so much to me. Alex B.
Alex. That doesn't rhyme with anything. Alex, you're my pal, except that you know that we are best friends, not just pals. And I love you, Alex.
Alex B.
How about, okay, so this person, this is interesting.
As if Alex B wasn't? How dare you? How dare you?
No.
Is this Dahmer Was Hungry?
Yeah, but I found out that person's name.
Well, I got to tell you, I met Dahmer Was Hungry at the show in Napa. Napa, California, right? I think I met Dahmer Was Hungry. Yes, I took a picture with Dahmer Was Hungry.
Oh my God. Tad? With Tad.
With Tad?
That's his name.
Tad, you're so freaking rad. You are a cool dude. Don't you get it? Don't you get all rude? Tad,
you are a dad, or maybe you're not. It's just a fad, but we love you, Tad. You're the best friend that we ever had. That was a guitar riff.
I gotta say, Tad, I didn't know that was his name, but we were taking pictures after the show and he came up to me and he was like, I have an Instagram handle. I did it a while ago. It's called Dahmer Was Hungry. I know. And I was like, I like your vibe. I like your vibe. I like it a lot.
No one would deny it.
And we do talk about Dahmer a lot in the show, or she does rather, because it's her favorite serial killer.
That's so cool. So what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did Tad go to the serial killer show and then meet you and then listen
yes.
to us? Rad.
Rad, Tad.
Rad, Tad. All right. How about Corinne? Corinne? C-O-R-R-Y-N.
Corinne. I think with a Y, it's Corinne.
Corinne. Do have gills and a fin. You are a mermaid in my heart, and you were from the start. Corinne, I hope you never grow legs. You know, I just watched The Little Mermaid, so I think that's what was going on there, but I can't be sure. It's like, you
Corinne,
never really know.
I hope for you that song was a win. What if we just did spoken word, Corinne?
Poetry.
I hope that song was a win. And you know, like Hamilton's Lynn. And then the other day.
You know what that reminds me of?
You have some gin.
Do you know this?
No. I don't know this.
Rose, jailbird, resting in her cage, no longer full of rage. She roosts.
So I married an axe murderer.
Yeah.
Harriet.
So good.
Sweet Harriet. So loving.
So knowing. So caring.
So true.
So love.
Ed.
dun 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 dun. He's so good. He's got like a beret.
You know that time I met. You know the time I had breakfast with Mike Myers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. How could I forget? Yeah,
I went to Bubby's. Thanks for buying my breakfast, Mike Myers.
I'm applying. One of the colleges I'm applying to keeps being signed. Oh my God! I can't believe you're applying to colleges.
This is wild. Sorry.
And growing up, one of the guys is named Mike Myers, and he's like, if you need anything, let me know, Mike Myers. And I'm always like, shivers.
Spooky.
So I never write him because I'm too scared he's going to kill me.
Oh, it's an odd day, so I think it's an odd time for Quinn to start.
All right, I'm going to tell you a story, and the story is the story of David Cam. This was a suggestion from Larry Posner.
One of our favorite, dearest readers, and also one of our favorite people who made Quinn.
Yes, definitely. Top two.
I'm not going to put them in order. I'm not going to do it.
I won't do it. I got this information from an episode of Dateline called, it had a good name.
They usually do.
Mystery on Lockhart Road. Is the name of that. And I got this from Courier Journal, All That's Interesting, NBC, Chicago Tribune, and Wikipedia. David Cam lives in Georgetown, Indiana, which is, explain this to me. When I read this, this is the sentence. He lives there, and then they called it a suburb of Louisville, Kentucky. How can you live in Indiana inside Kentucky?
Let me explain something to you. There are a lot of places in the world where states, like what borders touch. I don't know if you know how geography works, but sometimes states are close to each other. And so, for example, there's like a lot of tri-state areas, right? In New York, there's a tri-state area. And so you can live in Jersey and be a suburb of New York City, right?
No.
You can be in Chicago.
That doesn't make any fucking sense.
You can be in Chicago.
You live in Jersey or in a suburb of Jersey because it's in damn Jersey.
No, the thing is you can be in Illinois, in Chicago, right? Indiana is so close. Like Gary, Indiana is so close from Chicago that it's considered a suburb of Chicago. Because what is a suburb? A suburb is just like a sleeper
friendly
town.
A friendly neighbor town
to a big city, right? So
fine. So what they're trying to tell me
Southern
is
Indiana.
This
Kentucky,
is close to is Louisville.
Well, again, Quinn, I'm sorry, it's history and geography. I keep forgetting like that's something that's like hard for you to grasp.
Complete blind spot.
Indiana and Kentucky, neighbors, right next to each other.
I'll take your word for it.
Well, don't take my word for it. Go on Google Maps, not sponsored.
I'm not going to do that. In 1989, David marries the woman that will become his wife, which makes perfect sense. Her name is Kimberly Wren. They have two kids. And at the time of our story, Bradley, their son, is 7 and Jill, their daughter, is 5. Now, he was a state trooper and he's no longer a state trooper, I believe.
Okay.
But he is about to call some buddies that he needs their help because.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that slower? He's about to call somebody.
He's about to call some buddies. Somebody's who? The guys he used to work with.
Okay, so he's about to just call some of his old coworkers.
Okay, it's about to get sad.
I know, but I needed some comedy. I needed comedy in a minute.
I know.
We're always trying to blend.
It's a work in progress.
It's like a
beauty
sponge.
I thought you were going to say Beauty and the Beast. Who's the Beast?
It's me.
Hi, I'm the Beast.
It's me.
So at 9:30, after having played basketball with his friends at a nearby church, he arrives home and he calls the police at 9:30 because when he got home, he went in the garage and saw his wife shot to death on the garage floor.
Oh, God.
He registers this, and in the blink of an eye, he also registers that his two kids are in the car and have also been shot.
No.
His daughter is still strapped in her seatbelt in the back, and his son is sort of draped over the driver's side of the back seat, almost like he was looking for a way out, like he was trying to like get away from whoever did this. And he can tell just by looking at them that Kim and Jill were shot in the head. So it's like a lost cause situation. He does not see a bullet in his son's head. And so his first reaction is like, if anyone is maybe going to be alive, it's my son.
Right.
So he pulls him out of their Bronco and gets him on the floor of the garage, starts to administer CPR. It's not working. And he calls the police. He runs after calling them to his uncle's house, who's also a former state trooper. And he's like, my family's been murdered. My family's been murdered. And he follows him because they live in the same neighborhood. He runs to the house with him and he goes in the garage and he's like, David, it does not look like it. They're not here anymore, man. Like it's they're not going to be okay. And David just like falls to the floor, is just a mess, weeping. And the uncle's like kind of pulling him out of the garage till the police can get here because he's also clocking that
this
like
is a crime scene.
This is a crime scene at this point. And obviously David, without thinking, has done what any parent would do.
He's got his.
But he has contaminated the crime scene.
Yeah.
Because he pulled his son out of the car. The police, the troopers that know David, I should say he didn't call 911. He called like directly his, I don't know, the people he knew. Yeah. And was like, and I've heard the recording of this call and he's frantic in it. And it's heartbreaking. And he's basically, I think he probably called directly them because my assumption would be
that he was like, these are the people I know and they're going to come faster.
And he was saying on the phone, even in the recording, he says something like, get everybody here. And you wouldn't say that if you were calling the police. You don't call the police and be like, everyone come now.
I can't imagine.
Everyone means something to him.
He knows he's on staff. I assume where we're going with this is that he's going to be charged with this. But is my assumption based on what you're saying of contaminating things? It feels like if I had a direct line to someone, like if I had a personal relationship with the police, like I could imagine you would call them before 911. I could imagine because you don't know those people. You know these people.
Yes, I think you're right. So they arrive on the scene and like there's so much blood that when they get into the drive, like they're coming up the driveway and there's blood going down the driveway because this garage is filled with blood. And they come in and see Kim lying on the garage floor. She's in her underwear. Her pants are pulled down. Her shoes and socks are off and her shoes are placed. It's kind of a weird picture. Her shoes are together on top of the car, like set together on top of the Bronco. No one understands what has happened. They lock down the crime scene. I mean, David and Kim were married for 11 years. Their marriage was not without problems, but there wasn't anything. Nobody jumps at saying like that was a really unhappy situation. And he seems truly devastated. He says to the public, I don't know if this was a personal attack on me or meant to be a personal attack on my wife, but if they have any decency, any compassion in their body at all, they'll turn themselves in. So the fact that he called, the first thing that raises suspicion with the police is the fact that he made the call the way he did rather than dialing 911. Because you could also see that as these guys know me and I'm going to get some level of treatment
because
from
they
them.
Don't have any, he doesn't have enemies. It's like, she doesn't have enemies. It's like, how on earth, who did this? And you always go with the spouse or the people closest to them, always.
And he knows that. I mean, but he also, you know, he also knows that they know him. So I think like these people, when I say they know him, like the people that are interviewing him at the get-go are people that have been to his house for dinner. They've watched him interact with his family.
Right.
You know, they know his kids. They knew his wife. So there's a guy at the crime scene when this happens that's he's there to be a crime photographer to get evidence and stuff.
Right.
And he says to the police when he's looking around that he sees evidence of a cleanup. He also says that he sees high-velocity impact spatter on the shirt that Cam, that David Cam was wearing, okay?
Okay.
And that's true. There is blood spatter on David's shirt.
He was administering
CPR. But it's a little tricky because, well, that's what's tricky about it is that he got his son out of the car and he says he put his knee sort of in the middle of the back seat and that Jill, who had been shot in the head, remember his daughter, had blood in her hair and stuff. So just a little got on his shirt. Basically, when you look at that, you can say at best he contaminated the crime scene, and at worst,
he committed the crime.
He had something to do with it. They're going to go with the latter because 3 days later, they in fact arrest David and charge him. And I also saw some of the video footage of them talking to him and saying, like, the forensics say that this is high velocity. That the way that gets there is if you're the shooter.
Right.
Like, there's not another way that gets there. And you see him going, you're wrong, then get another expert. I don't know what to tell you, but you feel the defeat of this is not what happened, and now we're not going to know what happened. I need you to, like,
keep looking.
Like, the frustration is beyond being falsely accused. Yeah. And to me, it goes into a place of, like,
I don't care.
Oh, my God, you're not investigating this right. And I need to know who did this to my family. The story that they decide happened is that, okay, we actually think, because we heard from neighbors, somebody had called and said they heard gunshots at a later time at night. We think he did go to church, did play basketball, and then came home and did this and then called us. Spoiler alert, they're going to go to trial in a minute, and that theory is going to have to change. And the reason why it's going to have to change is that the time of death was earlier and was when he was at basketball. So they're like, okay, it can't be our idea that he, like, went home and did it. But that was their original thought. And at the first trial, one thing that happens is that the prosecutors get a bunch of women to take the stand. We're talking about days, I believe, that women are taking the stand and being like, here's what base I went to with him. Like, basically women that have been in the neighborhood, women that have been maybe pulled over by him. He's a charmer. He's a ladies' man. And he is, without a doubt, cheats on his wife all the time to varying degrees.
Yeah.
This was not a huge surprise, which is to say, like, she found out he was cheating when she was pregnant with one of their kids and almost left him, didn't leave him. But she recently had a conversation with a girlfriend and was like, it's all happening. She didn't say specifically what, but she was like, ugh, I just feel like history's repeating itself. Right. But they didn't get into it. But now that's like, okay, she knew he's cheating and he is cheating. And it makes him look like a total schmuck, because we're talking like a fellow trooper's wife goes up there and is like, yep.
So yeah, we've talked about this before. It's like,
you can be guilty of philandering and not of murder.
And not a murderer. One does not the other make. And I think, too, what's interesting about it is that she knew he was cheating and he had experienced cheating before. So it's like, it's not like she thought everything was perfect and then he cheated on her.
That's
like,
right.
That doesn't feel like enough motive.
It's not a straw that would break a camel's back. I agree. So then the other evidence that they say in this trial is that they're like, well, there's actually a phone call made to one of his clients from the residence at like 7:20, and he was meant to be playing basketball starting at 7. So his alibi is all fucked up. That call fucks up his alibi and says he was at home. He could have killed them earlier, like when you guys think they were killed around 8 or whatever. The other thing they're going to allege as motive is that he was molesting his daughter to be clear, there's no evidence of molestation, but the medical examiner says that there was blunt force trauma to her genitals in the 24 hours leading up to whatever happened. And they can't figure out what that story is. And so they're basically like, okay, he was molesting his daughter. Somehow the wife found out. That could also be a motive. It could be that. It could be the affairs. But we have this really important forensic evidence that is this blood spatter analysis of his shirt that we're saying had to have been high velocity. Now, during this trial, they do have another expert come forward and do the story I told you, that this doesn't look like high velocity. What it looks like is that when he reached the back seat, his daughter's hair touched his shirt. It's not high velocity. It's just contamination. And let me show you how it works. And they use wigs in the trial and they stage it and they show
the same.
Identical marks.
Oh, wow.
Identical marks. You know, not identical, but, you know, similar enough that you go, okay. And the other thing you have is you've got these 11 guys that played basketball with him going, I don't know. He was there the whole time. He didn't, like, leave. he gets sentenced to 195 years in prison. Like, it's just so, I think that the jury just fucking hated him. Because the wife was like really, really likable and working so hard and a really good mom. And then you've got this husband that's like really a shit husband.
Oh my God. And,
but in August of 2004, the Court of Appeals overturns it because they're like, the judge should not have let days of testimony that are just like character assassinations. They have nothing to do with the murder. They have nothing to do with the date. And I understand that the prosecution was thinking like, here we are, we're going to show you the motive. But having days and days of every woman he's ever had like any sexual contact with take the stand, there was no way. The jury was so biased at that point.
Right.
So they're like, no. So then the prosecutor refiles it and we go to trial number
due.
So, okay, one thing I haven't told you yet about the crime scene.
I knew you were holding out on me, Quinn. I knew you were.
A sweatshirt was at the crime scene.
Okay.
A sweatshirt that had DNA of an unknown male was in the garage. And they said, get it tested. And like, they're like, oh, it's unknown, but like nothing's coming up. Nothing's coming up. It doesn't get tested for years, because they've been told, like the defense has been told that it was tested, and like everyone passes the buck. It's like, hey, prosecution, you said you tested this. Did you not? And they're like, no, nothing came up. And it's like, but something did come up when we tested it against CODIS. So what the fuck happened? And it's like, this is either a case of somebody lying or it's a case of
laziness, of deceitful ignorance of like.
Yeah, it's like hard to say if somebody deliberately lied or if somebody like mistold somebody something. I don't know how this happens, but it is scary that it happens, because you have this smoking gun that is this sweatshirt not being taken seriously because they decided they knew who did it.
We've seen this before, though, Quinn. We've seen this
before. Oh, my God. It's just so wild, though. And it matches someone in the prison system named Charles Bonnet.
Bonnet. B-O-N-E-T?
Just I wish I could tell you because I
say
did just watch.
Say a couple of ways.
I'm going to commit to Bonnet.
Bonnet.
Charles Bonnet, who is known, you're going to freak out, as the shoe bandit. That's like one of his nicknames, because here's his history. He started off doing just very creepy things like pushing women over and stealing their
shoes.
Like
Jerry
basically.
Brudos. We haven't covered him, but it's Jerry Brudos, the shoe fetish slayer.
He's into feet. But wait, just picture this. He would do it sometimes wearing like a white China doll mask.
Oh, that's so scary.
Terrifying.
That is
terrifying.
And then it escalates, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And he goes and holds these three like young women at gunpoint and tries to get them in a car to take them somewhere. And someone sees and calls the police. So whatever was going to happen to them doesn't. But he only serves like 7 years and gets back out. So you will recall that those shoes were atop the car very neatly. And that although her pants were down and she was in her underwear wasn't off. There wasn't like a sexual thing that happened in that regard. But there was bruising on her feet. I don't know what happened there, but it looks like it was you that did it. Okay?
Oh, my God.
So they go and get this guy and they're like, we have your sweatshirt. It was in the garage.
The murder
and he's
scene.
Like, oh, I can see why that would be there. I did just drop it 2 weeks ago at a Salvation Army. And they're like, yeah, but it wasn't washed. And the Salvation Army doesn't take stuff that you drop in the donation box and then just put it on a shelf. They wash it. And your DNA was on it. So that doesn't really add up. And he's like, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. And they're like, well, we better not find anything else. Have a good day.
We're doing, we got,
and then
we
they
got our,
find something oh, else. His handprint is on the car, the Bronco.
Okay, so it's him. It's him. Tell me they switched direction. Tell me they switched direction. Tell me they.
Well, you would.
No, they double down.
Let me tell you what they do.
Jesus Christ.
They do this. They go, okay, now your handprint's on the car, so now we know you were in the garage. And he's like, no, I definitely wasn't. It's like he hangs on to that for hours and hours, maybe a day. And then he's like, oh.
That garage? He goes, oh, wait, you're talking about that garage. Oh, I got so, my bad.
And he's like, and they keep saying to him, like, you need to tell us what happened. He says, okay, I'll tell you what happened. What happened was I met this guy, David, at a pickup basketball game. And he found out I was a prisoner, and then he wanted to buy a gun from me. So I went to his house to sell him the gun. And then as soon as he bought the gun, he just like went in and attacked his family. I couldn't believe it. So like I went in there because I was scared. And he was basically
pretty like, sweaty, and I took my sweatshirt off.
And he's like, and he was like, I'm going to pin this on you. And he's like, so I guess now we see. And I'm like, okay.
Don't you think he would have brought up the pinning earlier when he got tried the
first
time?
When he got 195 years, you don't think he'd be like, I think I know who was there. This guy. Like,
he was saving it for the appeals. Jesus Christ.
It's beyond absurd. And there is just so much evidence against him. He does end up getting 225 years in prison.
Who?
On A
does.
Oh,
my God. I got worried it was
wait,
David.
Wait. His trial is concurrent with another trial. David's trial, where he's being tried as a fucking co-conspirator in his family's murder. Yes. So David's back in this second trial
overlapping. Sometimes you just have to admit that you're wrong and move on. Admit that you are wrong in accusing this guy and move on.
No, they would never. Instead, they're like, okay, we're going with the molestation theory in this trial. Like the first trial was heavily like the affairs. This trial's going to go heavy molestation.
Oh my God.
So they're like, we're going to go back to this really important evidence we have, this forensic evidence of the blood on David's shirt. And he had to have been within 4 feet of shooting his daughter to get that velocity. And then they have the experts coming up and say, no, it could have just gotten there. But they find him guilty again. And they give him life without parole. And a big part of why is that they really believe this molestation story. Because they get a forensic pediatrician saying, yes, like she could have been molested. There is also a medical examiner going up for the defense saying, no, like the child's hymen is intact. This was a blunt force trauma. That doesn't align with molestation. That's not the same thing. We don't know what happened, but if there was a fatal attack, she could have been hit a number of places. We don't know what happened. What happens in this particular instance is that this gets overturned in 2009. And the reason it gets overturned is that they are like, you alleged that you didn't have enough evidence. You said the whole reason was that he molested his daughter, but you actually didn't present enough of a case that a molestation even occurred.
So Jesus Christ.
There's just not enough evidence. Jesus so now Christ. We have to have a third trial. So now we're going to go to trial a third time. And they bring Bonet back in to like take the stand.
And he's already fucking admitted to it. Why is he dragging this guy down with him?
He has not admitted to it. He, in fact, what was so funny is he was like, here's my story. And I just ran in and then I ran out and they're like, and you didn't touch anybody. You didn't harm anybody. They find Bonet's DNA on Kim's underwear, on the arm of her shirt. They find it near an abrasion that they think was from her fighting him. They find it on her broken fingernail. They find it on the little girl's shirt who was in the car. It's a lot of DNA for someone that said he never touched any of the victims.
And whose story has changed multiple times.
Over and over and over again, because then it becomes like, well, maybe I did touch me. I mean, you can imagine. He's just adapting. And people are like, this guy's smart and he's a sociopath. So he's going to keep figuring out what he can do to get away, you know? Right. And it's just, it's so many different story changes. I cannot believe they let this guy even take the stand. I mean,
as a defense,
so
as a defense, wouldn't you want him to take the stand? So, because he's, the fact that the prosecutors, I mean, here's the deal. he should take the stand, because as a criminal defense attorney, you can go, I'm going to discredit everything he's saying and realize he's not trustworthy. And his is the only testimony that we have.
Oh, everything, though. I mean, they will lean on, oh, I didn't even go back to this. Do you remember the phone call?
Yeah.
That's because Indiana has like different time zones. They were just time zoning it wrong. He had that call like 6:15, not 7:15. And then he did go play basketball. And then everybody saw him playing basketball. And when Bonet tells the story of here's how this all went down, his timeline doesn't match the timeline of their deaths at all. It's just this thing where when you go back and you look at
what
the detectives were also like, you're going to die. They made it a race thing with Bonet. And they were like, you're going to get the death penalty. Don't you want to not get the death penalty? And then they were doing the thing where they like fed and adapted. They like kept feeding and adapting with him to get the story that would keep the heat on David.
Oh, God. Okay.
So I don't even know that it's Bonet being like, this is a great idea for me. I think that he like, you watch interviews where at the very beginning of this whole thing, they're like, do you know David Kam? And he's like, no, I've never met him. I don't know anything about him. And then you give him 2 days where the detectives are talking to him and suddenly they're best friends that played basketball together. Not best friends, but you know what I mean?
Wow.
Here's the thing. Here's the big thing. There is nothing, not a strand of evidence other than what comes out of Bonet's mouth that ties those two men together. There is no evidence that they
knew each other,
ever knew each other,
relationship.
That they ever, ever spoke. Yeah. And then most disturbingly, I would say, you have the sweatshirt at the scene of the crime. You have his DNA on it. You have his girlfriend's DNA on it. His prison nickname is written on the fucking collar of the sweatshirt. His Department of Corrections ID number is associated with that sweatshirt because it was prison issued. How did we have that sweatshirt and we did 3 trials?
Holy
how in the world? It wasn't even brought in as evidence of anything.
How is that not something? That is yes. Important. The fact that it wasn't destroyed, frankly, is a miracle. The fact that they had it and didn't destroy it because they knew it would destroy their case is a miracle.
Oh, you're going to love who testifies also in this trial. Do you remember the crime photographer from trial one? Who was at the scene of the crime, who was like, let me tell you something. There was a cleanup and this is how the high velocity blood spatter looks. Well, he's like, I got to get on the stand and just tell you, I did perjure myself in those first 2 trials because I know that when I said that it was high velocity impact, that was like basically what led to David getting arrested was when I said that. And then I like went on to tell everybody that I was like this blood spatter analyst and like knew a bunch of stuff.
Like, I watched 2 episodes
and
of
was
Dexter.
About to get a PhD, and none of that's true. That's not true at all.
Why aren't
I don't
we
have
vetting
any
these
of those
witnesses? He doesn't have a degree.
Not only that, but he's like the prosecutor. Stan Faith helped me make fake credentials. Like helped me create these fake credentials.
Oh my God!
Yes. And he's like, I actually was just supposed to be taking pictures and notes of the scene. And I don't have like any formal training. And then all the stuff I wrote down was used as probable cause to arrest David to begin with. And then they're like, why'd you do that? And he goes, it was a dumb thing. In hindsight, I would have kept my mouth shut. Like, yeah, it's a man's life who's been in jail for over a decade.
Oh my fucking God.
He wasn't even charged with perjury. He's just like,
this guy's been in jail for a decade?
Oh, yeah.
He's lost his
family. Being in jail. He was in jail 13 years right after his whole family was murdered. That's his life.
Wait, so what happened?
And everybody fucking hates him, and his wife's parents
think he did it.
He did it.
So
yeah.
Does he tell
like,
me
for
tell
sure
me they
can't
exonerate
drop it.
Him? Tell me they exonerate him.
Okay, so let me go over what happens. So Rob Stites is like, oops, I perjured myself. And then there's a bunch of other witness tampering stuff. Like there's a DNA analysis who's like, I want to come forward and say that in the first trial, Stan Faith threatened me when I wouldn't perjure myself.
Wait, the prosecutor?
Yes.
Threatened him?
Her, yes.
Threatened her?
Mm-hmm. And then there's a fingerprint analyst that comes forward and is like, yeah, that guy, Faith, he basically was like, can you kind of shade the truth about this palm print? We know it doesn't match David, but like, you know, like that kind of thing. And then
the fact that this is happening to someone who is in the law enforcement arena, like, I can't, can you, like, that to me is what's so surprising, is that he has, like, he has all these buddies in the force and stuff. And so it's like, it blows.
Which also you have to think about what it's like.
Exactly. For not a someone.
For a state trooper to go to prison. Not popular.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, not chill.
So the prosecutor just fucking...
So corrupt. So corrupt. And then you have this judge in this case that you hoped would just see this and, like, cut the guy a fucking break. But he does the opposite. And he says to the jury, I just want to remind you guys that you can find him guilty if you think he aided and abetted Bonnet. Like... which is like something that he should not be saying, because it kind of like is a double jeopardy thing, because he was not, he was acquitted of conspiracy charges in the second trial. He was just like charged with murder. So it's like, it's very confusing, but it's
I get it. And I think,
So then the defense attorneys are like, you can't do this. And then they're like, you also have to throw out all this forensic, not the only forensic thing you had that said he did it was the blood spatter. And we just heard from everybody saying that's a lie. So the good news is, in 2013, after spending 13 years in prison, he's found not guilty.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
I know. And the defense is basically like, the issue was that the prosecution only ever wanted him to be the one that did it, obviously.
Yeah.
So they just kept changing. They were like, every trial was just you changing the theory of the crime. So like, first trial, it's like, he's the shooter, he acted alone. Second trial, they're like, he's the shooter and Bonnet was there aiding and abetting. And now the third trial will do Bonnet is the shooter and he's aiding and abetting. And it's like, he said, we had three trials with the same proof. And they have three different theories. Proof doesn't change. If you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt,
oh my God,
you argue the same thing throughout. You don't have to constantly shift your theory to fit your proof. That's what he says. That's what the defense says. And I agree. It's wild. And luckily, Bonnet is still serving his 25-year sentence. He still is like, David did it. Because he's probably like, I don't know. I'm not going to say I did it. Why would I? I have no reason to, but Kim's parents, they believe him.
They still think that Dave...
They filed a wrongful death suit against him in 2014 after he finally got out.
They
dropped it. They dropped it eventually. And after his acquittal, he sued Floyd County in the state of Indiana for $30 million. He settled with Floyd County for about $500,000 in 2022, and he was just awarded $4.6 million in damages from the state for malicious prosecution and wrongful imprisonment. But
his family,
he's
gone.
A marked man. Not only that, there's just enough people that when you've had these three trials, there's just enough people that are like, I still think he did it. Do you know, like people that don't read between the lines and are like, that they can never forget that he was called guilty. I think like their brain just doesn't have space for that, because it is actually so fucking terrifying.
Oh my God.
He was hired as a case coordinator for Investigating Innocence, which is a national nonprofit that provides criminal defense investigations for inmates. And he became friends with the jury in the third trial. They like go to dinner sometimes.
But what about the first two trials? Are they friends? Do they hang out?
I don't think so. But they should apologize.
But you should really, if you were in a jury and you just go, "Oh, my bad.
I'm so sorry."
Oh God. Ugh.
So take your duty seriously.
Jesus. Have you seen Jury Duty yet on Amazon?
No.
Quinn, I told you to watch it.
Did you?
Yeah. Because I watched it when I was
at
your house.
It's funny or scary or what?
Funny. It's on Amazon Prime. The premise is this guy gets called to jury duty and he doesn't realize it, but it's basically Truman Show. He thinks he's getting called to jury duty and it's a documentary, but he's with all actors. Everyone's acting around him.
Oh my God, you did tell me. I dying to see that. Let me actually write it down,
it's
though,
so
because the thing is,
good.
I don't remember things unless I write them down.
It's so good. It's very
old.
Fun.
All right.
James Marsden
I'm
is in it as himself, which
under
is great.
TV. All right, here we go. Jury duty. All right. Would you like to tell a story?
Great. Okay, I'm telling this story. I got the information from Wikipedia, Biography, National Geographic, and there was a YouTube show video I watched called Elizabeth Bathory, The Blood Countess Documentary on YouTube.
Why do I know that name? Okay, Bathory. I just love it. Okay,
Elizabeth
let's
Bathory.
Do it.
She's born August 7th. So by the way, I feel like you're going to get a lot of serial killers content out of me in the next couple of days, the next couple of weeks, because
wait.
All I've been hearing are like more stories of serial killers. So I have to tell them to get them out of my head and get them into your ears. Okay. So, but this is like an old, old, old case. So it's Elizabeth Bathory. She's born August 7th, 1560 in Hungary.
It's a long time ago.
And boy. Was she hungry? I did write that joke down because it makes sense. Her parents, because like she's like some royalty, she's a countess. Like, listen, her parents are relatives. Let's move on. You know, Bathory, the name means good hero, which apparently is because someone in her lineage was a dragon slayer.
No brags.
She was very well educated. She spoke like a bunch of different languages, right? She's a rich bitch.
Mm-hmm. You okay, pal? What happened?
I was just gesticulating so much. And she banged, baby, she moved on this desk. I'm here for a night. Oy. I don't.
Looks nice, though.
I don't know my way around. It's not the best hotel, but it's certainly nicer than where I was last night. Okay. So she suffered from seizures and complained of headaches. And her family, I don't know which line, maybe it was both sides, but apparently it had a history of epilepsy. But it's the 1500s. Like, people don't know about it. And if you ask people what it is at the time, they're like, oh, it means you're mad. It means like you're not well. So they didn't really talk about it very much. But just something of note that I think will come back later was the treatment at the time for someone who is experiencing epilepsy is taking the blood of someone who does not experience epilepsy and rubbing it on the lips of the epileptic person.
I thought you were going to say drinking it, which I was close.
She was a Protestant. And what's important about this time is it's during the medieval times. And torture was like very much a way of the world. Like, people just be torturing. And as a upper class noble person, you could basically do whatever you wanted to your servants and peasants below you because you were the landowner. And basically you could just like, if anybody wronged you, you would just fuck them up. So it was important.
It sounds like how my kids treat me.
Let's see if you can relate to any of these stories. So at the time, it's worth noting that like if someone stole something, you would see their limbs cut off. Witches were burned or drowned. And I have to tell you an anecdote that I saw in this video, because if I have to hear it, you do too, which is there was this guy who was trying to lead a rebellion against the upper class, against the nobility. And he was caught before he could really, you know, do any harm. But his punishment was he had to sit on a burning throne while wearing a heated iron crown. So like burning him. So while he's sitting on a hot fucking throne, there's hot iron on his head. He's watching his younger brother get cut up in front of him while hot pliers are being dug into his skin, and his rebel friends were ordered to eat his flesh. And if they did not, they were threatened with death. So like, this is the world that we're creating.
I'm like, what?
Like, it's a little, it's a crazy. Frankly, hat on a hat. It's like an iron, it's like a hot crown on a hot crown on a hot crown. It's like too much. You've done too much.
Hey.
So it's important to note that like the-
They need a good editor, you know?
It was just like, you have some psychopath who's like, I know what we could do. It's like, ugh. So what's important to note is that at the time, I think people were very desensitized to torture, and that was deemed normal. And she was exposed to all of this, right? Like, all of this was very commonplace for her. What's worth noting is that her uncle is the highest ranking official in Transylvania. her other uncle was the Polish king, aka, and also the Prince of Transylvania. They're very rich. They're powerful. Her family lent money to the Habsburgs of Austria. What happened is at 10 years old, she is promised to a guy, you know, a political arrangement. She's promised she's going to marry this guy. And as custom was at the time, she was sent to live with his family. And when she was a teenager, she had an affair with a guy of lower class and she got pregnant. Apparently, her fiance found out at the time and cut off his penis and then threw him to dogs to be eaten alive.
And threw the penis to the dogs or the man?
The penis was already cut off. I'm sure the penis was thrown to them as well.
I'm sure the
penis was thrown to the dogs as well. And I hope.
Yeah, don't waste
and
it.
And I hope this is the thing we cut out for our reels. When we started this podcast, did I think I would say casually, his penis was thrown to the wolves? No, I didn't. But here we are, on Truly, Darkly, Creepily.
She's saying it.
Okay. So the child was either murdered or banished. We don't know, but this was just a rumor. Who knows? What we do know is that, like, she still goes on to marry this guy. So it's either, like, a testament to how powerful the family was that they could, that she could be, quote, ruined, and they still would want to marry her, or it's just a rumor. Mm-hmm. She kept her own name, which I think is also a testament to the power of the Bathory name. They had a bunch of kids. Apparently, only three of them survived into adulthood. And her husband went off and fought in a war. And while he was fighting in a war, it was her responsibility to take care of the house. So she was in charge. She defended her home since it was on the way to some of the battlegrounds. When women became war widows, she helped them out. What we know of, like, complaints is what we know is that of the time, if there were any issues with your landlord, you would write a complaint letter. And we know that she had no complaint letters levied against her. What's important to know...
Well, people were scared of her or she was great.
Yeah, we don't
what
know.
What do you think?
What is important to know is that her husband, though, he was really successful in the battlefield. And again, we talked about the time of torture, like how crazy it was there. He would play catch with decapitated heads. And so when her husband came back...
This is so Game of Thrones.
It's beyond Game of Thrones. It's like...
It's Ramsay, though. It's, like, this character is Ramsay.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So her husband came home and he was like, hey, I got some, like, great new ways to torture. He was like, what you want to do is you want to, like, coat a young girl in honey and leave her outside to be eaten by ants. You want to light oil paper and put it in between girls' toes. And she could dole out punishments to peasants for whatever she wanted to do. So, like, if, for example, if you got a little carried away and murdered a peasant, a servant, you would just be charged a fine. You know, it was kind of like shrug.
Yeah,
no
you
issue.
Don't go to jail or anything.
So rumors start spreading that, like, she really enjoyed torture. Like, she was kind of, like, into this. Her husband bought her a black claw as a gift, and she would, like, strap it to her hands and attack servants. She'd put needles under the nails of poor servant girls. And then, like, of course, around this time, we have some, like, Satanism and witchcraft rumors. Maybe it's Satan and witchcraft. Maybe she just loves torture. I don't know. So around this time, it was possible. I just love this name, and I'm so excited to say it. Around this time, there was this thing called gynecium, which is, like, basically.
Okay. I don't know what I'm picturing. It's like a gynecology appointment in a museum is what I'm picturing. Gynecium. Yeah, that makes sense.
A gynecium. Yeah, it's just like a bunch of stirrups. Really what it was is it was just like basically a finishing school. So it's like a group of ladies getting together, like sewing, learning etiquette, things like that. Typically, young girls would be sent to like a rich person, a rich woman's gynecium, and it served as like a finishing school. And what's important to know about Elizabeth Bathory is that she spoke multiple languages. She was very well off. She had a lot of money. Like, hello, branding. She was an influencer. Mm-hmm. We loved it. So people were like sending their kids to her gynecium. What people believe happened is that she started torturing women in this gynecium because suddenly the girls that came to her finishing school, her gynecium, started dying. And it was this weird thing where they would die and then she would be like, come pick them up, but only look at their face. And she was like, it's cholera. A bunch of them died from cholera. And 1602, and rumors are spreading. But again, to be clear, it was how she hurt the noble class that got her in some rumor hot water versus how how she treated the peasants.
There were no consequences. Yeah.
So what's important is that her husband's status was pretty high, and so nobody was investigating her. She was like so seemingly untouchable. When her husband dies in 1604, after the two of them are married for 29 years, she like inherited all of his power and money. And there was a guy that was enlisted to be her ward, essentially. And so soon after, these rumors started picking up, started spreading. A Lutheran minister denounces her, and the rumors adapt to she's actually a serial killer and a torturer of young women. So she hears these rumors and she's like, yikes, I got to get out of here. By the way, the guy who like became her ward also became like the lead investigator in this case at the time. So it feels like a little bit conflict of interest, but she's like, yipes, I got to get out of here. So she flees to the mountain for arrest, and a formal investigation into her crimes is launched in 1610. She is arrested with like five accomplices, servants. They start developing witness statements. They have about 52 witness statements against her in 1610. And next year, it's 300. Her case is brought to trial. But all of the witnesses are giving secondhand testimonies. They're secondhand witnesses. None of them, nobody was there for the crime. The victims were between the ages of 10 and 14 years old. What's important to note is the witnesses in her case were tortured while giving their statements. So we now know that they were given these under duress. Some people implicated one of her servants, her like main girlie, that she was like teaching her Satanism and witchcraft. I will jump back to this, but the claim is that she murdered 650 young women.
That's too many.
That is a lot.
I don't think she had time. I have to object to that number. That's too many.
So other reports say 50 or 60.
She just did. She'd have to be murdering like it's a full-time job.
Legitimately, the 650 was like somebody was like, oh, yes, yeah, some guy saw it in a book. And then when the guy testified, he never tested. But someone, one person said 650. And this is the power of rumors.
No fucking way.
This is the power of rumors compared. Like, it's like your story. It's like someone says it once and people believe it to be true. So yeah. What's important to note is that she died in 1614 at 54 years old while under house arrest. And because she wasn't officially convicted for these crimes, she was able to leave her wealth and power all to her kids. Of course, the family name was completely marred because she's this, quote, serial killer who murdered 650 women. And then 100 years after her death is when this story is first really written. And they referred to her as the Blood Countess. And what they add to this story, and again, to be clear, this was not mentioned in court transcripts of the time. Is there court transcripts of the time? Who knows? I don't know. I think there's like a stenographer writing this down. But 100 years later in 1729, this Jesuit guy wrote this story and said that she would bathe in the blood of her victims to keep her youth. So she is known as the Blood Countess.
Which, and her family's from Transylvania. I'm starting to understand the roots of some of these.
Yes. But I think, and then Dracula was written in 1897. So they believe that she was a direct inspiration to that story.
Totally.
What's important is when she was buried in the church, they were like, oh, wow, we have a serial killer in the church. Get her out of there. So nobody actually knows where her body was moved. So where her body is a complete mystery. What's important to note about this story is that when historians look back at this, because Elizabeth Bathory is known as the most prolific female killer who bathed in the blood, she's the Blood Countess, like she is like a demonic, like she just feels like this is her lore, right? Mm-hmm. When historians looked back at this, they start trying to find actual evidence of this.
Yeah.
And there is no physical evidence of this at the time.
Of all these murders? None. What?
Like, or there's like people died in her care. Like, people died in her care, but like 650 is a number one person said. We do know that she probably was into torture, like because of the times that she was born in.
Because everybody was into
that. Think about this. She had a ton of power, money. She also was Protestant, and it was at the time where like feelings against Protestantism was like ramping up. She was a widow, and so she had all this money and power, and so she became an easy target. And remember, I told you the person who was like her ward in charge of her care became the lead investigator in her case. So a lot of historians have come forth and been like, you know, we've talked about how this is the most prolific serial killer who bathed in the blood of her victims, yet there's not much to substantiate that. And was she just right. a victim by being a woman at a time who had a lot of power? Like what I said, like a lot of this stuff was written 100 years after the trial, like rumors be spreading. In 2018, she was inducted into the Guinness Book World Records as the most prolific female murderer, even though there is no evidence tying her to it. So she is living in the annals of history as mm-hmm. the Blood Countess, as this woman who murdered 650 virgins and bathed in their blood. But when I looked into it, it raises more questions. And it goes, is this fact? Or was this a part of like the witch hunt era where we were okay. crusading against women? So
It seems like it.
I mean, I don't want to malign the victims because I think she was into torture. I think like, was she a good lady? Probably mm-hmm. not. Probably not.
Right.
But was she a serial killer? I don't know. What I do know is that I'm so glad I wasn't born in the 1500s because I would have for sure been a servant and I for sure would have been tortured. And that's it. I had to tell you about this lady from Transylvania wow. who is called the Blood Countess from the 1500s.
This is a yeah. really wild story. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the story. Oh, I had wow. to tell you that.
Crazy. You had to.
But I also think it's interesting the parallels between that case and your case, which is someone can say
once somebody tells you a thing.
Once somebody tells you a thing, it becomes fact. And the longer it goes on, or like the longer the further away you are from it, the more ingrained in history it is. I'm so terrified of what people will say about our time. You know, like with social media, like if we become extinct, which maybe we
are robot.
If we become extinct and people come like dinosaurs and erect or find the ruins of our lives here and see what we said about one another, like what would they think about our society is sort of a question I have.
Well, I think they'd be really relieved to not live in our time.
I got to tell you though, learning about the medieval times, I'm kind of
glad. And to them, I would say, check out an Equinox because they're really great.
Have you been to a Kiehl's? No, I'm just saying though, like people might want to live in our time, but I got to tell you, I'd much rather live in our time than in medieval times. I'd want to go to medieval times, but I don't want
to. I don't know how you've been to medieval times.
I love a turkey leg. I love a chicken leg, but I'm not the medieval times of torture.
Holler for the purple night.
Hard pass. But anyway, this is straight up Game of Thrones. And I feel like Game of Thrones was deeply influenced by this case. Like I imagine the Red Witch. What's that bitch's name?
And Dracula. Oh, right.
Melisandre. Yeah. I feel like she's the Blood Countess in that.
God, I can't believe I had that right.
That was right at the tip of the lip. Right at the tip of the lip.
Super nerd.
Is that what people say? The tip of the lip?
The tip of the lip. The tip of the lip. The tip of the teeth.
Hey, dearest readers, join Patreon. Give us a review.
Please.
Live, laugh, love.
Learn, gather.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye, dear readers.